sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ronald Balson, the author of the new book, Once We Were Brothers. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's the magnificent fall season here in southern Arizona where I live, and that means not only the nicest weather of the year, but also that something wicked this way comes. The weird, pagan, sort of Christian holiday of Halloween is coming up this week, and having been part of debates at various times about whether Jews should celebrate Halloween or not, I figured I might as well weigh in on it. You should know that in Jewish circles, there's a great deal of debate about whether Jewish children should be permitted to celebrate Halloween at all, since its origins are surely not in our tradition. And the more you look into this orange and black holiday of trick-or-treating, skeletons, jack-o'-lanterns, and candy, the less and less Jewish it sounds. To begin with, the original sources for Halloween are primarily Celtic. It's derived from Irish, Scottish, even Welsh customs. When Britain was Christianized, these ancient Druidic practices associated with remembrance of the dead became known as the Night Before All Saints' Day, which was a kind of catch-all holiday celebrating all the Christian martyrs. The day after All Saints' Day, by the way, was called All Souls' Day, when all non-saints who died were remembered, sort of a giant Yisker holy day or a Kever Avot for non-Jews. The new festival, co-opted from the pagans, became the first of three straight days on the Christian ritual calendar and was therefore called the Night Before the Holy One's Day, or All Hallows' Eve, which eventually became Halloween. This all took some time to evolve. Like the public elements of the Christmas celebration that we know so well, Santa Claus and elves and the like, Halloween became popular in America only in the early part of the 20th century, roughly 100 years ago. In essence, Halloween came out of a deeply ancient pagan practice of doing Yisker, married to a Christian way to remember martyrs and the dead. Basically, it was a Memorial Day weekend without military overtones, or a weekend, a time to light a candle and remember all of those who had died. But leave it to us creepy human beings to take something sacred and solemn and make it, well, marketable and cheesy and weird. Over time, and with lots of social and commercial encouragement, Halloween has evolved into a full-fledged children's and teens festival with deeply ghoulish overtones, really bad horror movies, and a fair proportion of minor juvenile delinquency. So throw in the Mexican creation of the Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, which combines an old Aztec holiday of dressing up like the dead, creating altars for the dead, and feeding the dead their favorite snacks. You know, sugar skulls, fruits, and nuts, apparently. And you have a pretty much totally non-Jewish approach to everything. So why would Jews celebrate something like this? Now, before I sound too much like a really old fuddy-duddy, I must tell you that all the religious elements are basically gone in the American celebration of Halloween. There's no real reason to remember its very goyish background. I know I just did that, but it's still not really what it's all about today. And to prevent kids from enjoying the opportunity to collect free candy from all your neighbors seems wrong. However, for those parents in our Jewish Hebrew schools who criticize their rabbis for holding Hebrew school on Halloween afternoon because it impinges on their precious children's ability to collect cavity-causing candy and dress up like skeletons and blood-sucking monsters, Well, to you, I have to say, feh. Anyway, just as my own parents did, as an American rabbi, I've always permitted my kids to dress up for Halloween. After all, if it works for Purim, it can't hurt too much to do it now, too. And to trick-or-treat a bit after Hebrew school and after homework and after I make sure it's where it's safe. You know, there's nothing un-Jewish about some harmless, meaningless fun, as long as it isn't the only fun holiday your kids celebrate. So long as children dance with the Torah and with flags on Simchat Torah, light candles on Hanukkah, dress up and play carnival games and have fun on Purim, celebrate Shabbat with cookies and challah and good stuff, I find it hard to believe that wearing costumes and marching through a neighborhood collecting candy can be all that harmful to Jewish self-image. Bad for teeth, but not so bad for children's identities, really. You know, speaking of Hanukkah, as I just briefly did, I know it's hard to believe since it's not yet Halloween, but the Festival of Lights is exactly a month away. It's almost as though this year we are missing a month on the American Jewish calendar, jumping straight from October to December, but it's not like that. As most of you are probably aware of by now, for the very first time anyone alive can remember, and for the last time ever, Hanukkah begins this year the night before Thanksgiving, on Wednesday night, November 27th. It's a rare combination of latkes and turkey on November 28th that has everybody so amazed. Thanksgivica, perhaps? And while we have plenty of time here on Too Jewish to explore that conundrum in the next few weeks, it's not too soon to start with a preview of Hanukkah music. And so, to play us in on this pre-Halloween, but also 30 days before Hanukkah edition of Too Jewish, here's a lovely Sephardic Hanukkah song, Ocho Candelicas, from the wonderful Sephardic singer, Flori Jagoda.
Hanukkah linda está aquí, ocho candelas para mí. Hanukkah linda está aquí, ocho candelas para mí. Oh. Una candelica, dos candelicas, tres candelicas, cuatro candelicas, cinco candelicas, seis candelicas, siete candelicas, ocho candelas para mí. Muchas fiestas vou fazer, com alegrias e prazer. Muchas fiestas vou fazer, com alegrias e prazer. Oh. Uma candelica, dos candelicas, três candelicas, quatro candelicas, cinco candelicas, seis candelicas, sete candelicas, ocho candelas para mí. Los pastelicos voy a comer con almendricas y la miel. Los pastelicos voy a comer con almendricas y la miel. Oh. Una candelica, dos candelicas, tres candelicas, cuatro candelicas, cinco candelicas, seis candelicas, siete candelicas, ocho candelas para mí.
That was Ocho Candelicas, Eight Candles for Me, in preparation for the Festival of Hanukkah coming up in a month. Ladino is a mix of medieval Spanish and medieval Hebrew, and it's beautiful. By the way, only 30 more shopping days until Hanukkah. Our guest on Too Jewish this morning is a litigator, an attorney who self-published a novel about the Holocaust that has now become a sensation in the Jewish world. He is Ron Balson, and his book is called Once We Were Brothers. Meet him and find out why he did it when we return on Too Jewish. Tucson Hebrew Academy, the premier Jewish day school in southern Arizona, will celebrate its 40th anniversary in grand style. This year's Tikkun Olam celebration, gala, auction, and dinner is at the Tucson Jewish Community Center on Sunday, October 27th. The evening begins at 5:30 with a cocktail reception and silent auction. This year's special honoree is THA alumna, the late Anna Greenberg of blessed memory. Anna embodied Jewish values in action with panache and a great warm smile. She was not only a hero to the Tucson Hebrew Academy family, but to the entire community. Her courageous battle with cancer was fought with grace, a message, and a mission. It was an inspiration to us all. Renowned author and commentator Rabbi Jennifer Krause is the evening's keynote speaker, while Neshama Karlbach, a past guest of Two Jewish, and the extraordinary Josh Nelson collaborate for an unforgettable performance of Jewish music. Jim Colby is the Master of Ceremonies. Contact THA at 529-3888 to reserve your seat for an inspiring evening, Sunday, October 27th at the J. That's Tucson Hebrew Academy's 40th anniversary. Call 529-3888. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's author Ronald Balson. His book is called Once We Were Brothers. He is a litigator and came into writing this book by a very interesting path. Tell us a little bit about what kind of law you do and how you ended up writing this basically Holocaust story.
I've been practicing trial law, litigation, for 40 years in Chicago. I got involved in a case with a couple of entrepreneurs who were going to put in phone service in southern Poland, right after Poland opened up to the West. And they had an exclusive contract to install cell phone service in the mountain region of southern Poland. And that contract fell apart. So I was involved in litigation in Chicago. I had to go to Poland because that's where the witnesses were, the documents, the places that they were going to install the phone service. And so that brought me to Poland numerous times, and that's where I got my inspiration to write.
How similar is writing a novel to the kind of writing you do in legal cases?
Well, many judges would tell you I write fiction. I think it's good training. I think you have to parse your words. You have to be persuasive. You have to tell a story. You have to keep people interested in what you're saying. So I think in many ways, this is my first work of fiction, but I think that years of preparing motions and briefs and appeals do prepare you for writing fiction.
So in coming up with a fictional story about two, sort of adopted brothers, not exactly the story, but a Jewish boy growing up in Poland, the child who gets kind of brought into his family, and then along the way, well, I don't want to give away the whole story, but is accused of becoming a Nazi. Was there a personal family connection? Where did the idea of the story come from?
A lot of people ask me that. Was your family affected? Are they from Poland? Are the people in the book representative? And the answer is no. It's all a creation of my imagination. I just felt that from my trips to Poland, I just felt I wanted to tell a story about an average family like yours and mine in an average town. This town I picked somehow happens to have been 40% Jewish. It was a small town, maybe 25,000-30,000 people. It had a number of mixed cultures and religions, and I thought it would be representative of what families would have struggled through and how they would have been affected. The idea of having two boys who were close as brothers living together in the house and ending up on opposite sides of the war was just, my imagination.
We will explore that imagination and a little bit about how you got this book to market when we come back with author Ronald Balson here on Two Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, the head of the Israel Center, the Weintraub Israel Center here. Oshrat, last week we started talking about Shabbat in Israel, and you have an interesting personal take on that. Your family, well, tell us about your family background in that regard.
First, good morning, Rabbi.
Well, Boker Tov, I'm sorry.
You know, I keep hearing, or people think that everyone who lives in Israel are religious or kind of religious, but there's lots of Israelis that are secular. And we will talk more about it in our next shows, like what is the separation between religion
and dati.
No, but what is the separation in Israel between, you know, the state and the religious.
Oh, right.
Contribute to this, but it will for next time. So I'm the oldest in my family. And when I become like, when I was 10, my parents decided to become more Orthodox. I didn't understand then why, but I need to give up all the traveling on Shabbat and all the joy and the trips. So it kind of create like, I didn't like it. Let's put it simple. I didn't like it, so I refused to be an Orthodox in myself. And when my husband and I like had a family, even without even talking about it, we decided not to keep any, you know, any mitzvot in our house. And then when I 10 years ago, when I went to Cleveland, Ohio, in my first business trip to Cleveland, since I worked with them, a Jewish family hosted me for Shabbat dinner. As one who raised in an Orthodox family, to see a young girl under bat mitzvah age lighting the candle, it was already Shabbat here in Israel, everywhere.
It was dark, much
it was
long,
oh my
long
God,
after the time
and
to
then
light candles.
And then the boy was under bar mitzvah age and he did the kiddush and the mutzi. I was on the floor. I was in shock. And then after, I thought to myself, what a wonderful way to educate your kids to love Shabbat and, you know, to know all about and to love it and to practice it. And then actually I was asked like 2 days ago at Or Chadash congregation when I gave a talk, how it's influenced on me. And I can say I'm here because of it, because this kind of experience, it really allowed me to see, to understand that I can be a proud Jew, even though I'm not making all the mitzvot, but I'm trying to do them.
It's interesting. I think that Israel and America have a lot to teach each other about Judaism. And the perception has always been, you know, mostly from the Israeli side that, you know, what happens in America is second rate. It doesn't count. It's not authentic. But I don't think that's so. And I think we both have a lot to share and grow from.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's a give and take experience for all of us.
Masao matan.
Yeah.
A kind of religious commerce, if you will.
But yeah.
We will talk next week. Thank you, Ashraf.
Thank you.
When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the all Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking the last several weeks about Jewish identity in Europe and in the United States. There was an interesting article that came out about JCC's suddenly making a big impact, a splash across the pond in the UK, where they apparently haven't had American-style JCC's where you could work out and do Jewish stuff in a non, I don't know, religious setting. It raises a lot of interesting questions about the plethora of choices American Jews have and how it's different elsewhere. That's both positive and negative, right?
Right. It's interesting that you mentioned the UK because, as you know, I don't really consider that to be part of Europe. It's just like there's the continent, there's the US, and there's the UK, which is sui generis, sort of floating in the middle. But, you know, you remind me that most of the communities that I know well in Europe are small and, in many cases, largely or at least partially Sephardic. So in these settings, there's often one synagogue, which is Orthodox in theory and in practice, but many members who attend drive to synagogue on the Sabbath, even though they go to an Orthodox synagogue, because that is the synagogue. So they may be relatively unobservant in their personal lives, but they go to Orthodox services once a week or on every holiday or in some cases every day. And another feature of some of these smaller communities is that there is a type of community center, not nearly as extensive as what we're familiar with in America and what we've come to expect. There may not be a weight room, but there is a sort of social center where people do various things like
put on plays, gather together,
exchange gossip, socialize. And that function is distinct from the function of belonging to a particular congregation where you might also want to play cards or socialize or whatever, because the synagogue is, as it traditionally was, a place of worship. So in America, we have all these other choices. You can affiliate in so many different ways. You can be active on behalf of a Jewish charity, Jewish Family and Children's Services. You can do all kinds of things at the JCC and never set foot in a temple or a synagogue. And there are so many people who express their Jewishness merely by the fact that they have a lot of books in their home, or they
go to certain movies,
or enjoy certain comedians or certain styles of music. They like klezmer music, and that's the extent of their Jewish identity. And I don't want to be judgmental about that, but the fact is that the report, the survey to which you referred, raises some really alarming conclusions about what will happen to American Jewry in the next 100 years if current trends continue. And the numbers that they uncovered, I found shocking, not least of which was the fact that 37% of American Jews have no problem believing that Jesus was the Messiah. I mean, that goes back to the fundamental early split between Jews and Christians that I would like to address at least briefly in our next session.
Yeah, I should also note that in that survey, 39% said it was essential to their Jewish identity that you have a good sense of humor, and 19% said that following Jewish law was central to their Jewish identity. So it gives you a little bit of a perspective. John Stewart has more followers than the Lubavitcher Rebbe in American
right.
Judaism. We'll talk next week, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Morris is in the kosher restaurant one night and he notices a man and a woman sitting at a table near his, looking romantic as they stare longingly into each other's eyes. Then suddenly the man slides off his chair and falls under the table. Morris notices the woman doesn't seem to have seen this. She's suddenly looking in the other direction. He quickly comes over and says, "Lady, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your husband just collapsed and fell under the table." "No, he didn't," the woman replies. "He just walked into the restaurant." Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. The story of the twins, Jacob and Esau, begins this week in utero. Rivals from before birth, wrestling in their mother Rebecca's womb, the red-haired outdoorsman Esau and his grasping, domestically inclined younger brother Jacob spend our Torah portion of Toldot vying for their father's and mother's love and attention. Each is partly successful, each partly fails. That sibling rivalry shaped the course of our people's early history, but it can also teach us something about ourselves. First, a word about words. Toldot is rich in real-life details told in spectacularly perfect writing. Rebecca, pregnant with the two boys wrestling inside her, tells God, "If it's like this, why am I alive?" Prefiguring the words every pregnant mom thinks or says at some point. Esau is hairy and rough at birth, Jacob smooth, born holding fast to Esau's heel. Esau, famished from the long hunt, trades his birthright for a bowl of stew, and then ate, drank, stood up, left, and disdained, a series of active verbs delineating his turbulent, thoughtless character. Jacob, smooth-faced, smooth-talking lawyer types that he is, audibly calculates the coming consequences of each action. Now, on to that little rivalry. The familial tension in Toldot is palpable throughout. In fact, there's Tsoros enough to go round for everyone in this small family. Isaac, the father and link between more important patriarchs, finds trouble everywhere, but avoids it by simply moving on. Each time, he finds more success and then more trouble, and moves yet again. Rebecca sees the wayward ways of her oldest boy, Esau, and chooses to manipulate the situation to give the inheritance to Jacob, remaking birth order retroactively. But the great struggle is between Jacob and Esau. I'm reminded of the 1960s TV stars, the Smothers Brothers old line, "Mom liked you better." Mom certainly liked Jacob better, while Dad liked Esau best. That kind of favoritism cannot end well, and in the short term, it doesn't. At the end of our Torah portion of Toldot, Esau has been doubly defrauded, while Jacob is forced to flee the consequences of his own duplicity, running from the only home he has known without so much as a blanket. In a sense, this conflicted family damages each of its members. All are wounded, none left really whole. It's a drama worthy of the great writers, or of so many of our own lives. And yet, in a couple of more Torah portions, we'll see that each member of this now shattered nuclear family has played or will play a central role in furthering God's design for our world. In spite of their mistakes and injuries, each helps ultimately to carry out pivotal elements that further God's mission, that will create the great people of Israel. In challenging times and in conflicted families, it's often hard to see that ultimately there is a divine plan or a place for each participant. But Toldot, which means generations, teaches us that in spite of what we might perceive in our own small field of vision, God remains at work in the world. Through all of our struggles, we may very well yet be furthering a great plan. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Ronald Balson, will tell us what motivated him to write about a secret identity, a hidden past, and the ultimate triumph of justice, all in a now wildly successful novel about the Holocaust called Once We Were Brothers. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
While in most cases municipal elections in a foreign country are far from newsworthy all the way over here in America, it's notable that Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat won a second term last week in a dramatic campaign against ultra-Orthodox challenger Moshe Leon, who was backed by two national political figures. Barkat got 51.1% of the votes in the Yerushalayim municipal elections, while Leon received 45.3% of the vote. This race was not easy at all, Barkat said in his victory speech. It was one of the hardest, most complicated races that you, me, everyone has ever seen. Barkat called on all council factions to join his coalition. Tonight I want to embrace the people of Jerusalem and send out a message that we need to join forces, including those who worked against us, Barkat said. Despite his victory, Nir Barkat will have to deal with a difficult city council as the ultra-Orthodox factions continue to grow stronger. The defeated challenger said, I didn't come here seeking a job, but I love the city of Jerusalem. Leon refused to take questions. Despite campaign promises that he would stay in Jerusalem even if he wasn't elected mayor, he announced he would be returning to Ramat Gan to head his accounting firm. Backed by influential Israeli Knesset members Avigdor Lieberman and Aryeh Deri, Leon hoped to take Jerusalem from the secular Barkat, forming a large Haredi ultra-Orthodox bloc that supported him. But apparently Jerusalem is not yet the ultra-Orthodox enclave that its Israeli secular critics sometimes claim. In other news, just to note some of the ridiculous elements of the Arab world's attempt to pretend that Israel doesn't exist, last week in Dubai, in the Arab Emirates, was the site of a swimming World Cup event. The national team from Israel competed very successfully in a variety of events. The competition organizers, however, had both the scoreboard and television coverage avoid mentioning Israeli swimmers and the word Israel at all. In the opening qualifying rounds, this merely seemed disorganized, but as more and more Israeli swimmers reached the finals in Dubai, it became an embarrassment for the meet officials. Swimmers couldn't tell if they'd qualified for the finals in any meeting in which an Israeli did, because they just didn't list the winners on the scoreboard, and they left the Israelis completely out of the TV coverage. Finally, on the last day of competition in Dubai, the event's organizers stopped interfering with the broadcasts and the poolside scoreboard and recognized the existence of the Israeli swimmers as one Israeli after another got a medal. It highlights the absurdity of those who pretend that Israel, now 65 years old and counting, simply doesn't exist. Sooner or later, okay, probably still later for some of these nations, the Arab ones especially, they are just going to have to stop this foolishness, no? And in a truly weird and wild story, a prominent Hungarian anti-Semite, Csanag Szegedi, discovered a year ago that he was actually Jewish. The former number two man in the ultra-right-wing neo-fascist Hungarian Jobbik Party and a member of the European Parliament, Szegedi had a record of vicious anti-Semitic rhetoric and public hatred of Jews and gypsies. Until... huh. Szegedi once said, "This budget proposal reads like a document written by Shimon Peres during a European Parliament debate. It's a budget that will make the Hungarians poorer and the rich Jews richer." He accused what he called the Jewish intelligentsia of doing harm to the holy throne of St. Stephen, Hungary's first king, the legendary founder of the Hungarian state. Having been outed by rivals in his own ultra-right party for having Jewish grandparents who survived Auschwitz and therefore a Jewish mother, making him Jewish, Szegedi has now embraced his Jewish heritage, traveled to Israel to visit Yad Vashem, and developed a friendship with Chabad rabbis in Hungary. He supposedly attends synagogue and is trying to learn how to keep kosher. This is a little bit like hearing that Hermann Göring suddenly was outed for his Jewish background and started going to shul. Needless to say, Szegedi's Jobbik political party was less than thrilled about his heredity, and subsequently he resigned from all his fascist party positions. As Szegedi describes his journey, "I hurt other people. When I spoke disparagingly of Jews or gypsies, I was also harming children who had never done anything wrong and may have talents that they could develop. But I blocked their path," he conceded. "You start hating until the hate becomes an aim unto itself. At the beginning, it was the crimes of the gypsies. Then it was anti-Semitism. And then we also started hating Romanians and Slovaks because they persecuted a Hungarian minority. Ultimately, you hate the whole world and most of the peoples because they have not met your standards." You know, I have certainly heard and read tales of tshuva, repentance and return, before, but I don't think I've ever heard of anything quite like this one from Hungary. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world.
Our brothers, the house of Israel.
We're delighted to welcome back our guest, author Ron Balson. His book is called Once We Were Brothers, a terrific, basically a great read about a Holocaust-era story brought up to date. Two brothers, as we talked about earlier in the show, sort of a Jewish boy growing up, that family adopts a Polish kid who then turns on them, and the rest of the story is really quite amazing, is how he gets revealed later. You published this book on your own. That's kind of a courageous step.
The book was finished, and I marketed it. You know, as an unknown author, it's pretty tough to get into the publishing stream, and there are lots of steps you have to take. There are maybe a million fiction books written a year. Everybody thinks they've got a terrific book, and it's tough to break in. And I sent it around. I sent it to numerous agents. I got postcards. I got letters saying, this isn't for us. This doesn't pique my interest. I don't think this book is very good, or I can't take on another author right now, or keep trying, and that sort of thing. So finally, after about a year and a half of that, I said to my son, you know what, I'm going to publish this on myself. Let's form our own publishing company, which we did. And we published it, marketed it, got it on various ebook download sites like Amazon. And from there, it was just a word-of-mouth situation, which is incredible, really, when you think about it, because we really didn't do any marketing to speak of. We never did any advertising. We never, you know, it's just someone reads a book and passes it on to another person, and I've spoken in a number of synagogues, and then ultimately, after we had sold maybe 130,000 books, St. Martin's called me up and asked me if I would like to be republished, have the book reissued, which it has been this October.
You know, I don't know how often that happens, but it surely is not very often that a self-published book makes it. Do you know of any others?
I wrote a piece for a blog about people who had self-published, and it's surprising. There are a number of people who have self-published their books to begin with. I can't recall the names offhand, but it would surprise you. There are people who have done that. I don't think it's common. I don't think it's something that happens every day. But my memory is that I think that if 50 Shades of Grey was initially self-published.
A little bit of a different kind of book, really. But
a little bit.
I remember reading a book once of a great author's rejection letters from publishers. Do you ever go back and look at those?
No, I threw them all away. It's devastating to get those every time one comes.
Feels like your child's being rejected.
It does.
You have, obviously, a great deal of experience in the courtroom. How much did that influence you in your writing?
As I said to you before, the courtroom is it's a place of storytelling. It's a place of persuasion. It's a place where you try to get your ideas across. And I don't know, part of my writing was to tell the story of the Nazi occupation and the Holocaust and the terrible situation which befell the Polish people. But I wanted to wrap it up in a good yarn, because I think that when you tell a story and you can have people identify with the characters, then the story sticks with you longer and you can appreciate just the bare facts better.
In conceiving of the characters, I was particularly thinking of Piatek, the secret Nazi who basically masquerades as a Jew. How did you, how did you feel about writing this guy?
I think I felt writing him as people would feel reading him. I mean, it's a dastardly character in a very clever situation. I expect most writers have this phenomenon, but when you invent these characters, they become real in your mind. You actually know them, and they are their own characters, and they have their own lives, and they may not be what you think, but it's what they think. And you try to attribute those personality traits to them, and that's, in writing Otto Piatek, I tried to be true to his character.
And, of course, we do know of secret Nazis who have had long lives in America after the war. Have there been others who have pretended to be Jews?
Well, I don't know that there's anybody that I've come across fits into the character of Elliot Rosenzweig or Otto Piatek. I just spoke to JCRC up in Minnesota, and they're dealing there with this man named Perkich, who was accused of being a Nazi, and they're determining up there what they're going to do. The Justice Department is what they're going to do with this fellow. It's not uncommon for there to have been Nazis to sneak into the United States after the war. They estimate some 10,000 did.
Right.
And the U.S. has the right to denaturalize them and deport them if they can show that they lied on their
naturalization papers, right?
So maybe, yeah, they've done so maybe 100 times, that's all. Hmm. So there are people here. I mean, there have been people here, close to 10,000 still. So maybe some do masquerade as Jews. I haven't come across any.
In writing the character Solomon, did you rely on anybody you knew, or was it just sort of a composite for Ben Solomon?
I think it was a composite. None of the characters in the book are actual people I know. They're just conglomerations of different traits of personalities that I know, I suppose, and they're not actual.
Having spent a fair amount of time in Poland now, what is the Polish people's, in your experience, how does the Holocaust resonate for them? Does it just feel like a Polish tragedy? Do they remember the Jewish aspect of it?
Well, I can only tell you my impressions. I'm not an expert on Poland by any means, but I can tell you that going to Warsaw, I don't know if you've been there, Rabbi, but going to Warsaw, there are so many monuments and memorials and dedications to not just the Jews, but the Polish underground and the freedom fighters. And they're all over the town, and you walk even through the areas where they have nice restaurants and boutiques, and you can see there's still bullet holes in the wall. Maybe a plaque will say, here in 1942, the Nazis gunned down 25 people. It's very emotional. It's very moving. And there is no question but that there has been a statement made by the Polish people about the war. As to how they treat Jews now, I don't know that there's a significant enough Jewish population in Poland even to make that statement. They say that there are some communities that are coming back, but when I was there, I really didn't see any significant Jewish population.
Yeah, it's certainly quite a contrast. All right, so are you a dancer?
No. My wife will tell you that. I'm not a dancer, but I do dance. So how's that?
I mentioned that because dancing plays a prominent role in the book and in the character of the protagonist and his wife who has passed away when we get to the beginning of the book. So I just wondered if there was something there for you.
Well, my wife likes to dance. I dance with her. I'm not a dancer.
That's okay. My wife won't let me dance with her. What's your next book?
The next book, the manuscript's at the publisher's now. The next book is, there's a follow-up on a couple of the characters, so you can say it's a sequel of sorts. Liam Taggart is repeated, and Catherine Lockhart, the attorney, is repeated. But the next book is current. It's about present day, and it's based in large part in Israel. There's a lot of discussion in the book, a lot of history in the book about Israel, about its borders, about its conflict with Palestinians, and it's wrapped up in a yarn. It's wrapped up in a story, hopefully a page-turner, as they say, which involves a lawyer who has gone missing. His daughter has been kidnapped and taken off to Hebron, Israel, and there's $88 million missing as well. So that's, in general terms, synopsis of the book that's going to come out probably next year.
How much fun is it to say the book's at my publisher's now?
It's fun. It's fun to say that there's an established market, and I have a passionate fan base and all of those things, which when I first wrote Once We Were Brothers, we certainly didn't have.
I want to thank Ron Balson for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Once We Were Brothers. Of course, it's available everywhere books are sold and downloaded. And good luck with the next book and continued success with this one.
Thanks very much for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Oh, I forgot to ask you one thing. So if they make a movie out of it, who do you see cast in the leads?
I wrote a piece for a blog called my book, The Movie. So if you can find that online, a bunch of us sat around trying to think of who we would have play in the roles, and I wrote a piece. But we thought, very briefly, we thought Anthony Hopkins would be good for Elliot.
Of course.
And we were torn between Alan Arkin and Dustin Hoffman for the part of Ben.
Of Ben Solomon. I like Dustin Hoffman better in that, but Alan Arkin would be okay too. Thanks again, Ron.
You're very welcome.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Maestro James Conlon, the 2012 Kohan Foundation Award winner, whose classical music project, Recovered Voices, has revived and performed and recorded the music of Jewish composers murdered by the Nazis. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Great Festival of Lights. It's from the contemporary band The Levies, and it probes one of the great mysteries of this coming season. Just how do you spell Hanukkah? My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good Halloween. Well, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Is it with a C or H? I am confused. What about those N's and K's? Do you use one or two? I remember when I was back in elementary school, a Spanish kid told me that it starts with a silent J. But Julio was wrong, or maybe he was right. Can someone decide? And Webster's, is there an answer to my question? Someone, please help me. Just tell me, how do you spell Hanukkah? I was watching a spelling bee on ESPN2. And these kids were spelling words that don't come naturally to me or you.
Like oligarchy,
solipsism,
bouillabaisse,
epistemology,
insouciant,
onomatopoeia,
syllogism,
perspicacious,
hypothalamus, there's some other ones.
Hot dog!
No.
Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Yeah.
I like hot dog.
But I bet they would get stumped if they had to spell Hanukkah. No one can tell. We don't mean to dwell. But how do you spell?
Try to spell check and Webster's. Is there an answer to this question? Someone, please tell me, how do you spell? Ask teachers, ask family. Nobody ever knows the answer. Someone, please help me. Just tell me.
No one can tell. We don't mean to dwell. But how do you spell?